Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
In winter, the roads up this end of the county test a driver's character. Go-getters, hustlers, and corner cutters just can't seem to stay on them. Crosswinds and heavy snows are the least of it. The devil is in those roads themselves. All those sleepy straightaways and views of scrubby, nothing hills, followed by curves out of nowhere that strike on a grade and ice-plane the tires, and then you are skipping off into air. The steering wheel a plaything, there for fun. Most people freeze and hold a steady course, but some who have come to me afterwards for tows have said how the suddenly freed-up wheel was something they felt like spinning, and did spin. And these are the people who flip and fare poorly, at least in my experience.
You're listening to the unique voice of the late Roscoe Lee Brown, reading from Walter Kern's Devil of a Curve, which we'll hear in its entirety later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Each of the two stories on this broadcast has something to do with the act of seeking, questing, searching for the way. In the first, The Mappist, by Barry Lopez, the older man says to the younger, "You represent a questing but lost generation of people. You think an elegant order has disappeared, something that shows the way." The older man is a master mapmaker, and finding him and his secrets is a great step in the younger man's quest. At the Getty Center in Los Angeles, Joe Spano read The Mappist by Barry Lopez.
When I was an undergraduate at Brown, I came across a book called The City of Ascensions, about Bogota. I knew nothing about Bogota, but I felt the author had captured its essence. My view was that Onésimo Peña had not written a travel book, but a work about the soul of Bogota. Even if I were to read it later in life, I thought I would not be able to get all Peña meant in a single reading. I looked him up at the library, but he had apparently written no other books, at least not any in English. In my senior year, I discovered a somewhat better known book, The City of Trembling Leaves, by Walter Van Tilburg Clark, about Reno, Nevada. I liked it, but it did not have the superior depth, the integration of Peña's work. Peña, you had the feeling, could walk you through the warrens of Bogota without a map and put your hands directly on the vitality of any modern century. The baptismal registries of a particular cathedral, a cornerstone that had been taken from one building to be used in another, a London plane tree planted by Bolivar. He had such a command of the idiom of this city, and the book itself demonstrated such complex linkages, it was easy to believe Peña had no other subject, that he could have written nothing else. I believed this was so, until I read The City of Floating Sand, a year later, a book about Cape Town, and then a book about Jakarta, called The City of Frangipani. Though the former was by one Franz Hartmann and the latter by a Jemboa Tran, each had the distinctive organic layering of the Peña book, and I felt certain they'd been written by the same man. A National Library search through the University of Michigan, where I had gone to work on a master's degree in geography, produced hundreds of books with titles similar to these. I had to know whether Peña had written any others, and so read or skimmed through perhaps 30 of those I got through interlibrary loan, Some, though wretched, were strange enough to be engaging. Others were brilliant, but not in the way of Peña. I ended up ordering copies of 5 I believed Peña had written, books about Perth, Lagos, Tokyo, Venice, and Boston. The last, a volume by William Smith Everett called The City of Cod. Who Peña was, I could not then determine. Letters to publishers eventually led me to a literary agent in New York, where I was told that the author did not wish to be known. I pressed for information about what else he might have written, inquired whether he was still alive. The book about Venice had been published more than 50 years before, but got nowhere. As a doctoral student at Duke, I made the 7 Peña books the basis of a dissertation. I wanted to show, in a series of city maps, based on all the details of Peña's descriptions, what a brilliant exegesis of the social dynamics of those cities he had achieved. My maps showed, for example, how water moved through Jakarta, not just municipal water, but also trucked water, and street by street, the flow of rainwater, and how road building in Cape Town reflected the policy of apartheid. I received quite a few compliments on the work, but I knew the maps did not make apparent the hard, translucent jewel of integration that was each Peña book. I had only created some illustrations, however well done. But had I known whether he was alive or where he lived, I would still have sent him a copy out of a sense of collegiality and respect. After I finished the dissertation, I moved my wife and 3 young children to Brookline, a suburb of Boston, and set up a practice as a restoration geographer. 15 years later, I embarked on my 4th or 5th trip to Tokyo as a consultant to a planning firm there. And one evening, I took a train out to Chiyoda-ku to visit bookstores in an area called Jimbocho. Just down the street from a bridge over the Kanda River is the Sanseido bookstore, a regular haunt for me by then. Up on the 5th floor, I bought 2 translations of Japanese writers' books on the Asian architectural response to topography in mountain cities. I was exiting the store on the ground floor, a level given over entirely to maps, closing my coat against the spring night, when I happened to spot the kanji for Tokyo on a tier of drawers. I opened one of them to browse. Toward the bottom of a 2nd drawer, I came upon a set of maps that seemed vaguely familiar, though the entries were all in kanji. After a few minutes of leafing through, it dawned on me that they bore a resemblance to the maps I had done as a student at Duke. I was considering buying one of them as a memento when I caught a name in English in the corner. Corliss Benefideo. It appeared there on every map. I stared at that name a long while, and I began to consider what you also may be thinking. I bought all 13 maps. Even without the language to identify information in the keys, even without titles, I could decipher what the map maker was up to. 1 designated areas prone to flooding as water from the Sumida River backed up through the city's storm drains. 2 showed the location of all shops dealing in Edo period manuscripts and artwork. 3 using small pink arrows, showed the point of view of each of Hiroshige's famous 100 views. Yet 4 in 6 time-sequenced panels, the rise and decline of horse barns in the city. Well, my office in Boston was 14 hours behind me, so I had to leave a message for my assistant asking him to look up Corliss Benefideo's name. I gave him some contacts at map libraries I used regularly and asked him to call me back as soon as he had anything, no matter the hour. He called at 3 a.m. to say that Corliss Benefideo had worked as a map maker for the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey in Washington from 1932 until 1958, and that he was going to fax me some more information. I dressed and went down to the hotel lobby to wait for the faxes and read them while I stood there. Benefideo was born in Fargo, North Dakota, in 1912. He went to work for the federal government straight out of Grinnell College during the Depression, and by 1940 was traveling to various places. Venice, Bogota, Lagos, in an exchange program. In 1958, he went into private practice as a cartographer in Chicago. Now, his main source of income at that time appeared to be from the production of individualized site maps for large estate homes being built along the north shore of Lake Michigan. The maps were in oversized books, 20 by 30 inches, and showed the vegetation, geology, hydrology, biology, and even archaeology of each site. They were subcontracted for under several architects. Benefideo's practice, his Chicago practice, closed in 1975. The facts said nothing more was known of his work history, and that he was not listed in any Chicago area phone book, nor with any professional organizations. I faxed back to my office asking them to check phone books in Fargo, in Washington, D.C., and around Grinnell, Iowa, Des Moines, and those towns, and asking them to try to find someone who, at what was now the National Geodetic Survey, who might have known Benefideo or could provide some detail. When I came back to the hotel the following afternoon, there was another fax. No luck with the phone books, I read, but I could call a Maxwell Hebert at the National Survey who'd worked with Benefideo. I waited the necessary few hours for the time change and called. Hebert said he had overlapped with Benefideo for 1 year, 1958, and though Benefideo had left voluntarily, it wasn't his idea. Well, what you had to understand about Corliss, he said, was that he was a patriot. Now, that word today, I don't know, means maybe nothing. But Corliss felt this very strong commitment to his country and to a certain kind of map-making. And he and the survey just ended up on a collision course. The way Corliss worked, you see, the way he approached things, slowed down the production of maps. Well, that wasn't any good from a bureaucratic point of view. He couldn't give up being comprehensive. You understand? And they just didn't know what to do with him. Well, what happened to him? Well, the man spoke five or six languages, and he had both the drafting ability and the conceptual skill of a first-rate cartographer, so the government should have done something to keep the guy, and he was also very loyal, but they didn't. Oh, his last year they created a project for him, but it was temporary. He saw they didn't want him. He moved to Chicago, but you said you knew that. Do you know where he went after Chicago? I do. He went to Fargo. And that's the last I know. I rode him there until about 1985. He'd have been in his 70s. And then the last letter came back, no forwarding address. So that's the last I heard. I believe he must have died. He'd be, what, 88 now. And what was the special project? Well, Corliss, you know, he was like something out of a WPA project. Like Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, James Agee, and them. People who had this sense of America as a country under siege, undergoing a trial during the Depression, a society that needed its dignity back. Corliss believed that in order to affect any political or social change, you had to know exactly what you were talking about. You had to know what the country itself, the ground, the real thing, not some political abstraction, was all about. So he proposed this series of 48 sets of maps. This was just before Alaska and Hawaii came in. A series for each state that would show the geology and hydrology, where the water was, you know, and the botany and biology and the history of the place from Native American times. Well, 100 people working 100-hour weeks for a decade might get it all down. You know, it was monumental, what he was proposing. But to keep him around, to have him in the office, the survey created this pilot project so he could come up with an approach that might get it done in a reasonable amount of time. Why, I don't know. The government works on most things forever. But that's what he did. I never saw the results, but if you ever wanted to see disillusionment in a man, you should have seen Corliss in those last months. He tried congressmen, he tried senators, he tried other people in commerce, he tried everybody, but I think they all had the same sense of him, that he was an obstructionist. They'd eat a guy like that alive on the Hill today, just the same way. He just wasn't very practical, but he was a good man. I got the address in Fargo and thanked Mr. Hebert. It turned out to be where Benifideo's parents had lived until they died. The house was sold in 1985, and that was that. When I returned to Boston, I reread The City of Ascensions. It's a beautiful book, so tender toward the city, and proceeding on the assumption that Bogota was the living idea of its inhabitants. I thought Benifideo's books would make an exceptional subject for a senior project in history and geography, and I wanted to suggest it to my older daughter, Stephanie. How, I might ask her, do we cultivate people like Corliss Benifideo? Do they all finally return to the rural districts from which they came, unable or unwilling to fully adapt to the goals, the tone of a progressive society? Was Corliss familiar with the work of Lewis Mumford? Would you call him a populist? Stephanie, about to finish her junior year at Bryn Mawr, had an interest in cities and geography, but I didn't know how to follow up with her on this. Her interests were there, in spite of my promotions. One morning, several months after I got back from Tokyo, I walked into the office and saw a note in the center of my desk, a few words from my diligent assistant. It was Benifideo's address, box 117, Garrison, North Dakota, 58540. I got out the office atlas. Garrison is halfway between Minot and Bismarck, just north of Lake Sakakawea. There's no phone. I wrote him a brief letter saying I'd recently bought a set of his maps in Tokyo, asking if he was indeed author of the books, and telling him how much I admired them and that I had based my PhD dissertation on them. I praised the integrity of the work he had done and said I was intrigued by his last survey project and would also like to see one of the Chicago publications sometime. A week later, I got a note. Dear Mr. Trevino, it read, I appreciate your kind words about my work. I'm still at it. Come for a visit if you wish. I will be back from a trip in late September, so the first week of October would be fine. Sincerely, Corliss Benifideo. So I located a motel in Garrison, got plane tickets to Bismarck, arranged a rental car, and then wrote Mr. Benifideo and told him I was coming, and that if he would send me his street address, I would be at his door at 9 a.m. on October 2nd. The address he sent, 15088 State Highway 37, was a few miles east of Garrison. A hand-rendered map in colored pencil, which made tears well up in my eyes, showed how to get to the house, which lay a ways off the road in a grove of ash trees he had sketched. The days of waiting made me anxious and aware of my vulnerability. I asked both my daughters and my son if they wanted to go. No school was starting. They wanted to be with their friends. My wife debated, then said no. She thought this was something that would go best if I went alone. Corliss was straddling the sill of his door as I drove into his yard. He wore a pair of khaki trousers, a khaki shirt, and a khaki ball cap. He was about 5'6" and lean. Though spry, he showed evidence of arthritis and the other infirmities of age in his walk and handshake. During breakfast, I noticed a set of The City of books on his shelves. There were 8, which meant that I had missed one. After breakfast, he asked if I'd brought any binoculars and whether I'd be interested in visiting a wildlife refuge a few miles away off the Bismarck Highway to watch ducks and geese coming in from Canada. He made a picnic lunch, and we drove over and had a fine time. I had no binoculars with me and little interest in the birds to start with, but with his guidance and animation, I came to appreciate the place. We saw more than 1 million birds that day, he said. When we got back to the house, I asked if I could scan his bookshelves while he fixed dinner. He had thousands of books, a significant number of them in Spanish and French, and some in Japanese. The 8th book was called The City of Geraniums, about Lima. On the walls of a large room that incorporated the kitchen and dining area was perhaps the most astonishing collection of hand-drawn maps that I had ever seen outside a library. Among them were 2 of Mackenzie's map sketches from his exploration of northern Canada, 4 of Fitzroy's coastal elevations from Chile, made during the voyage with Darwin, 1 of Humboldt's maps of the Orinoco, and a half-dozen sketches of the Thames docks by Samuel Pepys. Benifadeo made us a dinner of canned soup, canned meat, and canned vegetables. For dessert, he served fresh fruit, some store-bought cookies, and instant coffee. I studied him at the table. His forehead was high, and a prominent jaw and large nose further elongated his face. His eyes were pale blue, his skin burnished and dark, like a Palermo fisherman. His ears flared slightly. His hair, still black on top, was close-cropped. There was little in the face but the alertness of the eyes to give you a sense of the importance of his work. After dinner, our conversation took a more satisfying turn. He had discouraged conversation while we were watching the birds, and he had seemed disinclined to talk while he was riding in the car. Our exchanges around dinner, which was quick, were broken up by its preparation and by clearing the table. A little to my surprise, he offered me Mexican tequila after the meal. I declined, noticing that the bottle had no label, but sat with him on the porch while he drank. "Yes," he said. He'd used the pen names to keep the government from finding out what else he'd been up to in those cities. And yes, the experience with the survey had made him a little bitter, but it had also opened the way to other things. His work in Chicago had satisfied him. The map sets for estate architects and their wealthy clients, he made clear, were a minor thing. His real business in those years was in other countries, where hand-drawn and hand-colored maps still were welcome and enthused over. The estate map books, however, had allowed him to keep his hand in on the kind of work he wanted to pursue more fully one day. In 1975, he came back to Fargo to take care of his parents. When they died, he sold the house and moved to Garrison. He had a government pension. When he said this, he flicked his eyebrows, as though in the end he had gotten the best of the government. He had a small income from his books, he told me, mostly the foreign editions, and he had put some money away so he'd been able to buy this place. "What are you doing now?" "The North Dakota series. The work I proposed in Washington in 57. "The hydrological maps? The biological maps?" "Yes. I subdivided the state into different sections, the actual number depending on whatever scale I needed for that subject. I've been doing them for 15 years now. 1,651 maps. I want to finish them, you know, so that if anyone ever wants to duplicate the work, they'll have a good idea of how to go about it." He gazed at me in a slightly disturbing, almost accusatory way. "Are you going to donate the maps then to a place where they can be studied?" "North Dakota Museum of Art. in Grand Forks. Did you never marry? Never have children? I'm not sure, you know. No, I never married. I asked a few times, but was turned down. I didn't have the features, I think. And early on, no money. Afterward, I developed a way of life that was really too much my own on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, I've been the beneficiary of great kindness in my life. And some of it has come from women who were or are very dear to me. Do you know what I mean? Yes, I do. As for children, I think maybe there are one or two in Bogota, Venice. Does it shock you? People are not shocked by things like this anymore, Mr. Benefideo. That's too bad. I am. I've made my peace with it, though. Would you like to see the maps? The Dakota series? Mr. Benefideo took me to a second large room with more stunning maps on the walls. 6 or 8 tiers of large map drawers and a work table, the perimeters of which was stained with hundreds of shades of watercolors, surrounding a gleaming white area about 3 feet square. He turned on some track lighting, which made the room very bright, and pointed me to a swivel stool in front of an empty table, a smooth, broad surface of some waxed and dark wood. From an adjacent drawer, he pulled out a set of large maps, which he laid in front of me. As you go through, swing them to the side there. I'll restack them. The first map was of ephemeral streams in the northeast quadrant of the state. These streams, he pointed out, run only during wet periods, some but once in 20 years. Some don't have any names. The information was strikingly presented and beautifully drawn. The instruction you needed to get oriented, where the Red River was, where the county lines were just enough, so it barely impinged on the actual subject matter of the map. The balance was perfect. The next map showed fence lines along the Missouri River in a central part of the state. These are done at 20-year intervals, going back to 1840. Fences are like roads. They proliferate. They're never completely removed. The following map was a geological rendering of McIntosh County's bedrock geology. As I took in the shapes and colors, the subdivided shades of purple and green and blue, Mr. Benefideo slid a large, hand-colored transparency across the sheet, a soil map of the same area. You could imagine looking down through a variety of soil types to the bedrock below. Or, he said, and slid an opaque map with the same information across in front of me, the yellows and browns of a dozen silts, clays, and sands. The next sheet was of 18th and 19th century foot trails in the western half of the state. But how did you compile this information? Inspection and interviews, close personal observation and talking with long-term residents. It's a hard thing, really, to erase a trail. A lot of information can be recovered if you stay at it. When he placed the next map in front of me, the summer distribution of Swainson's hawks, and then slid in next to it a map showing the overlapping summer distribution of its main prey species, the Richardson ground squirrel, the precision and revelation were too much for me. I turned to face him. I've never seen anything that even approaches this. My gesture across the surface of the table included everything. It's not just the information or the execution. I mean, the technique is flawless, the watercoloring, your choice of scale, but it's like the books. There's so much more. That's the idea, don't you think, Mr. Trevino? Of course, but nobody has the time for this kind of field work anymore. Well, that's unfortunate, because this information is what we need, you know. This shows history and how people fit the places they occupy. It's about what gets erased and what comes to replace it. These maps reveal the foundations beneath the ephemera. But what about us, though? I blurted out, resisting his pronouncement. In the books, in City and Aspic in particular, there is such a palpable love of human life in the cities. And here, I do not have to live up to the history of Venice, Mr. Trevino. He interrupted. But I am obliged to shoulder the history of my own country. I could show you here the whole coming and going of the Mandan Nation, wiped out in 1837 by a smallpox epidemic. I could show you how the arrival of German and Scandinavian farmers changed the composition of the topsoil in the places where Charles Bodmer painted and the evolution of red light districts in Fargo. All that with pleasure. I have nothing against human passion, human longing. What I oppose, Mr. Trevino, is blind devotion to progress and the banality of material wealth. If we're going to trade the priceless for the common, I want to know exactly what the terms are. I had no response. His position was as difficult to assail as it would be to promote. You mean, I finally ventured, that someone else will have to do the maps that show the spread of the Walmart empire in North Dakota? I won't be doing those. His tone was assertive, but not testy. He wasn't even seeking my agreement. My daughter, I said, changing the subject, wants to be an environmental historian. She has a good head for it, and I know she's interested. She wants to discover the kind of information you need to have to build a stable society. I'm sure it comes partly from looking at what's already there, as you suggest, like the birds this morning, how that movement, those movements, might determine the architecture of a society. I'm wondering, could I ever send her out? Maybe to help. Would you spend a few days with her? I'd be glad to speak with her, he said, after considering the question. I'd train her, if it came to that. Thank you. He began squaring the maps up to place them back in the drawer. You know, Mr. Trevino, Philip, if I may, and you may call me Corliss, the question is about you, really. He shut the drawer and gestured me toward the door of the room, which he closed behind us. You represent a questing but lost generation of people. I think you know what I mean. You made it clear this morning, talking nostalgically about my books, that you think an elegant order has disappeared, something that shows the way. We were standing at a corner of the dining table with our hands on the chair backs. It's wonderful, of course, that you brought your daughter into our conversation tonight, and certainly we're both going to have to depend on her thinking. But the real question now is, what will you do? Because you can't expect her to take up something you wish for yourself, a way of seeing the world. You send her here if it turns out to be what she wants, but don't make the mistake of thinking you or I or anyone knows how the world is meant to work. The world is a miracle, unfolding in the pitch dark. We're lighting candles. Those maps, they are my candles, and I can't extinguish them for anyone. He crossed to his shelves and took down his copy of The City of Geraniums. He handed it to me, and we went to the door. If you want to come back in the morning for breakfast, please do. Or there is a cafe, the Dogwood, next to the motel. It's good. However you wish. We said goodnight, and I moved out through pools of dark beneath the ash trees to where I'd parked the car. I set the book on the seat opposite and started the engine. The headlights swept the front of the house as I turned past, catching the salute of his hand and then he was gone. I inverted the image of the map from his letter in my mind and began driving south to the highway. After a few moments, I turned off the headlights and rolled down the window. I listened to the tires crushing gravel in the roadbed. The sound of it helped me hold the road together with instinct and the memory of earlier having driven it. I felt the volume of space beneath the clear, star-ridden sky and moved over the dark prairie like a barn-bound horse.
Joe Spano read The Mappist by Barry Lopez. We'll be back after a short break with a story read by Roscoe Lee Brown. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. The author of our second story, Devil of a Curve, is Walter Kern, who hails from Livingston, Montana, and the story takes place in an isolated spot up a winding country road where the said Devil of a Curve brings many a speeding car to grief. The first-person narrator is regularly called upon to get out his tow rope to haul back on the road the vehicles that have gone off the road in front of his house. Where are they all heading? And why are they driving so fast? Devil of a Curve was read by the wonderful and stylish actor, the late Roscoe Lee Brown.
In winter, the roads up this end of the county test a driver's character. Go-getters, hustlers, and corner cutters just can't seem to stay on them. Crosswinds and heavy snows are the least of it. The devil is in those roads themselves. All those sleepy straightaways and views of scrubby, nothing hills, followed by piss-draining curves out of nowhere that strike on a grade and ice-plane the tires, and then you are skipping off into air, the steering wheel a plaything, there for fun. Most people freeze and hold a steady course, but some who have come to me afterwards for tows have said how the suddenly freed-up wheel was something they felt like spinning, and did spin. And these are the people who flip and fare poorly, at least in my experience. I've opened my door on sights so ungodly gruesome and uncalled for that I've had to purify my vision by staring at a naked, burning light bulb. Generally, though, it gives me a kick, the fixes that people get themselves into. And that is why I keep the tractor all gassed up and conspicuously parked there. My porch light stays on from Thanksgiving to Easter, day and night. I tape the switch up. Last year, when things had been slow for a while, I went out and stood on the road sighting back and found that there were branches in the way. I took the chainsaw to them and things picked up again. Most people offer me money for my services. Without exception, I turn it down. Some of the drunks, the men, will go so far as to dump out their wallets or slip a ring off their finger. Here, they say, sounding more self-disgusted than grateful. I hand them back their valuables and have them sit down while I heat some coffee. Often when I get back to the table, the men are bawling, spilling out their sins. They tell me where they were that night and why they should not have been there. With a teenage girl, perhaps, or running around with buddies while the wife was home alone. One man I had here a few years back claimed he had robbed a liquor store downstate. He even dialed the sheriff so I could turn him in. I wouldn't do it. Like so many others who wept in this kitchen, the store robber spoke of his crash as a judgment, which I suppose it was. That was back when my wife was still with me. She sent the man off with a bundle of tracks. Gail was reorganized LDS, Latter-day Saints, a pure strain of Mormon. The only payment I do accept is the damaged vehicle itself. Quite often, it's just not worth it to people to have a car repaired, especially when there are hospital worries. How much people waste has always amazed me. Jelly jars that make fine little tumblers, pencils that are only halfway down, road-killed deer that they could legally take home. But I have learned that you can't teach thrift. All you can do is soak up others' surplus. Rarely do I sell my cars for scrap. The car I drive now, for example, is based on a 67 Novus chassis with features from other classic GM makes going all the way back to 1950. Ever since I sold my livestock and got into Christmas tree farming, I've had some empty building on the place, so warehousing parts is not a problem. Still, it is probably time I rang the junk man. Car parts today are not what they used to be, not so all-purpose and lasting, but good for only 1 year and one model. For anything else, you're out of luck. It's just so hard to throw things out, though. You wouldn't believe how it tickles me, having some special part on hand for someone who busted it off in the ditch. This girl who showed up last night, though, has not made up her mind. She may want repairs, or she may want to walk from here. I'm in no hurry to make her decide. Victims have stayed overnight here before, and only once have I minded the company. I'm not a judgmental person, but this man told me lies. He stood on my porch for a while without knocking. I watched him from the upstairs window. He had on fancy ski clothes, brilliant purple, a color I suspect did not exist before this century. People in shock get confused, and that's how he looked, standing there in a whirl of snow, waving a snapped-off rearview mirror. His other hand was covering his ear. Just as I reached the door, he knocked. Timid-sounding knocks, no more than taps, as if he had not yet decided whether he wanted aid. For a moment, he would speak to me, and I thought he was going to turn and run. A handsome man with an ear streaming blood that I saw when he took his mitten away. I dabbed at his head with a moistened cloth, and soon he started to talk, a mixture of nonsense and fine detail. He'd had a drink, he said, but only one. He hadn't been speeding. He loved his country. He loved its laws and had always obeyed them. All he'd been doing that day was skiing. Skiing cleared the lungs. He used to smoke. He'd cut it out and become an outdoorsman. He ran a corporation in the city. When I asked him his name as a test of shock, he changed the subject to Christmas trees. "I see by your sign you raise furs," he said. "Sounds like a very rewarding business." "Mister, I think you're in shock," I told him. "I am in shock," he said. Curious thing to say, if it was true. When I asked him about his car, its condition, all he said was, "Write it off. We'd never find it anyway. It's buried." Then he asked to use my phone, in private. Later, I picked out his calls on my bill, one to our local county seat, 10 minutes, and one to Minneapolis, 20. One to the authorities, that is, and one to the people who own the authorities. After he got off the phone, he told me, "I'd like to lie down now. I'm still in shock. I came to your house in shock." Next morning, I found some change on the sofa. The man had disappeared. I drove my farmall out to the highway, but just as I topped the hill before the curve, a deputy came running up and told me to get back to the house, that the ditch down below was a sealed-off area, no matter that the land was mine. By now, I had pretty much guessed the whole story. The dead passenger, a boy, as it turned out, was referred to in the papers as the hitchhiker. The driver, Milton Frick, philanthropist, had fled from the wreck in amnesiac shock and collapsed at the home of an elderly farmer. Cursing out the deputy, I started into a three-point turn. A Cadillac stretch job with tinted windows appeared at the crest of the icy hill, inching along for sure attraction. "The girl is in my son's old bedroom. I hope she's made herself comfortable there and will stay until tomorrow, when Tom is supposed to fly down for the holidays. The truth is, it's more of a girl's room than a boy's room. All those religious samplers on the walls, a bedspread alive with Bible scenes. Like me, my wife was hoping for a boy. The conflict between us lay elsewhere, in the kind of boy we hoped for. Except for wanting average size and weight, I had no specific expectations. But Gail had a child prophet in mind, a second Joseph Smith. She wanted a fairy who spoke in tongues, a scholar. He had to be pure, so she bought him stiff white shirts. Even outdoors in the fields with me, he had to wear a collar. Otherwise, she wouldn't fix his lunch. He wasn't allowed to drink coffee or tea or watch TV outside of the news shows. Gail approved of the news shows because she thought they proved to Tom how near the second coming was. So many wars and storms. I should have spoken up, but I kept quiet. The boy was on her side, not mine. The only togetherness Tom and I had was hauling wrecked cars out of snowbanks, a job that would fascinate any young man. Tom made his mother proud with his faith, but when she died, he lost it. Fast. At 18 years old, he moved to Alaska, swearing it was money from now on, nothing for him but countable cash. He has a job in oil now and tells me he could retire if he chose. That's how rich he is. He writes me downhearted letters sometimes, complaining that he's missed so much of life and that there are no nice women up there. Well, I have a nice one here with me now, and I think my son would like her. I found her in the ditch. Julie, the girl, sits down to eat breakfast. The sweater I gave her last night in the snow is wrapped around her shoulders. Cute. This will be the first square meal she's had here. She's already told me a lot about herself, that she has a problem with drugs, cocaine, and that she was driving stoned at the time. That her family, what's left of it, lives off a fund established by her grandpa, an engineer with a bolt named after him. That she was in college until last month, but left when she took her first exam and realized she was being timed. She tells me that what she hates most is time. Not just clocks, but time. She calls it an aggressive male invention. What's odd is that she told me all these things before we had made it back to the house. While we were still on the tractor, towing. Julie is a talker. What do you want with your eggs, I say, sausage or bacon? I'm sorry, I don't eat red meat, she says. Pork isn't red, I tell her. Yes, it is. I am the farmer here, but why begin the morning with a quarrel? Do you mind if I smoke at the table, she asks. Be my guest, I tell her. I'm amazed that she still has her cigarettes. I had to drag her out through the window. Her car was that submerged. Julie smokes. I eat. We both drink coffee. She asks me about my Christmas trees. I tell her that in the 70s, the market for real trees bottomed out, and I went hungry for three seasons running. Everyone wanted aluminum then, a clean decoration that doesn't shed. But then when Reagan got in, I tell her, strangely, she still appears to be listening, real trees came back with a vengeance. Business has been healthy ever since. It just goes to show you, Julie says, laughing. Fascism always. She stops. She regards her long ash and frowns. I really shot off my mouth last night, didn't I? Maybe I said some things I shouldn't have. Forget it. You were in shock, I tell her. Now, what was this about trees and Hitler? I don't want Julie to lose momentum. It's 16 long hours till Tom gets home. Nothing, she says. I'm full of shit. I've never even held a job. You know that? You're a girl, I say. That's natural. Julie looks away from me. Listen, I say, after too much silence. You want some cocaine? I dug some out of a car seat once. I'll bet it's still around here somewhere. It isn't like me to get my hopes up, not when other people are involved. By 5 in the evening, with Julie long gone, A girlfriend from the city came and got her. They took away a 6-foot tree. I am ready to live without hopes forever, hopes of any kind. What am I so in need of anyway? Not a thing. The world as it is brings bounty to my doorstep. After a lot of tricky prying, I managed to raise the hood on Julie's Escort. I hook my shop lamp into the grill. The car is mine, she told me, so long as I talk up the damage level when her insurance agent calls. Still, I'm not sure if I want this car, even for parts. It's too tinny. A twig not even as thick as my finger is rammed straight through the radiator. That's the quality metal we're talking. Just working in the shop is soothing, though, and so I get my jack out, pump the handle. It makes me feel strong to raise a car this light. But you can lift, huh? That's what shows you. Once I could lift my wife and my son, one on either shoulder. Then it was just my wife. Then it was only the smaller furs. Now I have people cut the trees themselves. I let them make an adventure out of it. They seem to prefer it this way, tramping along through the snow with their saws. I get the car up. I shouldn't already be dizzy, but I am. And now I can feel myself breaking my vow and giving in to hope. A boy showed up at my door one night, a school friend of Tom's. I recognized the jacket. His face was another story, however. No one would have recognized that face. Too much glass and blood, too little hair. One of his eyes was all puffed shut, the healthy one. I must have made some noise when I first saw him, because my son called down the stairs then, asking what was wrong. I yelled at his mother to keep him up there, one of the few commands I ever gave her. Now that Tom has grown, though, I think he could stand to see it all. I hope he comes down from Alaska for good. I won't be around forever, I'll tell him. And someone has to watch over that curve.
Devil of a Curve by Walter Kern was read for us by the late Roscoe Lee Brown. There's a little time left in this program to share with you some recent letters we've received from listeners about stories that particularly moved them and how selected shorts fits into their lives.
To whom it concerns, I'm a 23-year-old recent college grad living abroad in Italy and just wanted to say thanks for keeping me company here in my kitchen while I sew Boy Scout patches and men pants for the kids for whom I au pair. Your program has made me laugh, dream, gasp, and write, not to mention forget that I am so far from college and America. Keep up the excellence. I deeply appreciate it. Big bookwormy kisses.
I am currently traveling through Asia and have discovered Selected Shorts, iTunes podcast, as a tremendous source of joy during my long hours on the road. As an Asian American in Asia, it's a strange time where identity issues are re-examined from a new perspective. What I admire about the work of Haruki Murakami and Ken Leong is that one can often replace the protagonist they portray with someone of any ethnicity with the same neurosis, hang-ups, and baggage.
Dear Selected Shorts, I love the show and listen whenever possible. I find the broadcast touching, amusing, entertaining, and numerous other reactions depending on the story being read. It puts me in a place that is distinct. No other radio or TV listening or viewing affects me the way hearing these short stories affects me.
Living in an old house that needs a lot of work, there's little time to sit and read during the day. Thanks to your program, I've made numerous trips to the dump with Tolstoy, scraped, primed, and painted with Marquez, and planted hundreds of bulbs with Flannery O'Connor.
Dear Symphony Space, this afternoon, in my car at an unaccustomed time on a Saturday, I heard the beginning of Selected Shorts, then continued listening when I got home and prepared dinner. The program featured a story about baseball, specifically old fans replacing AstroTurf with real grass secretly during the baseball strike. Then Bart Giamatti read a lyrical piece on baseball. I could feel myself smiling as I listened. To my delight, the program turned out to be Selected Shorts from Symphony Space. This flooded me with memories. When I was a little girl, my grandparents lived at 93rd in Amsterdam, and my grandfather worked as a ticket taker for a movie theater on Broadway. My sister and I considered him in his cap and uniform the epitome of elegance and a very important person in show business. Learning that the stories I so enjoyed came from the block on Broadway that holds such memories for me made the experience even richer. I loved the word picture of the way the stage looked as the old baseball reading took place. Thank you for a very special afternoon.
I accidentally tuned in for last night's reading of the Iliad, and it was the most pleasant surprise I've had on radio. I never expected a dusty old piece of literature to turn out to be beautiful, moving, breathing, the very best poem anyone could imagine. Now I know what all the fuss was about. I get it. Thanks.
Some words from you, our listeners. Thanks for writing.
We'd like you to know about the new Selected Shorts website, selectedshorts.org. It has everything you could ever want to know about Selected Shorts live, on tour, on CDs, on podcasts, on downloads, everything you've ever wanted to know and what you can tell your friends. selectedshorts.org.
Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs, presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from Audiophile Magazine, a print and online resource for audiobook reviews, recommendations, and features on audiobook narrators. More on the world of audiobooks at audiophilemagazine.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.